Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. Well, when you get over there, also click on that Here We Still Stand banner, because you're going to want to come to the virtual conference. You're going to want to be sitting there at home in your pajamas on a Friday morning, just watching 40 Minutes in the Old Testament live on your computer screen or on your TV or on your phone or your tablet, whatever you're going to watch it on. Then you're going to move into some talks from all the regular people. It's going to be a good time. The nice thing about it is that you can have all your snacks. It's like binging. I know that all you guys have got a Netflix show that you got into and then you just binge the whole thing. Well, that's what you're going to do with Here We Still Stand this year. It's just like a binging fest, but you don't have to get dressed for it. You can just sit around eating junk food, getting the gospel. So join us. All you got to do is sign up, and then we'll send you a link at the appropriate time so you can join up. It's absolutely free. Go check it out. Chad, what's going on, man?
We've got some very nice listeners. You know, I was just looking through some recent reviews that we have on iTunes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you guys for that.
Yeah.
That's a huge help, too.
Yeah. It's encouraging. Nice to know that all the as we've passed a million downloads, Chad, as we mentioned a few weeks ago, it's nice to know that those aren't all hate listens. So that's good.
Right.
That's good. Cause you can get a lot of listens two ways. You can have a lot of people that really enjoy what you're doing, or a lot of people that you're living rent free in their head and they listen to everything you do because they just hate you so much that they can't get enough of you. So it's good to know that's not all that, because the reviews are very encouraging. So thank you for that. Yeah. And besides that, they are helpful. They make the podcast more visible on search engines and that stuff. So if you haven't rated and reviewed the podcast and you do enjoy it, that's extremely helpful. So we appreciate those of you who have rated and reviewed. And if you haven't, well, we'd appreciate it if you would. Yeah, it goes a long way.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Thank y'all. So you ready to do battle? We're getting ready to battle here. So we left off last time right on the brink of a war between, once more, the Philistines and the Israelites. So we have to find out what happens here. So the ark has been returned. We talked about that last time. And it kind of got moved around, shifted from place to place. First ended up in a place called Beth Shemesh. Things did not go well there with those folks, because they peeked inside the ark and a lot of people died. So they shipped it off to Kiriath Yearim, which I didn't mention last time, but is just kind of a side note here. Probably Kiriath Yearim is probably Emmaus. At least, I believe it was in 2019. I think it was last year. Archaeologists found some evidence that it actually was Emmaus. If you're interested, you can Google that, read a couple of the articles there. But anyway, it's about the same distance from Jerusalem as Emmaus was. So pretty likely identification of Kiriath Yearim with the New Testament city, the city that we're familiar with from the New Testament, that being Emmaus. So anyway, it stays there for a long time. The people are brought to repentance, the preaching of Samuel. They offer sacrifices. They have this water pouring out ceremony. And they're gathered at a place called Mizpah, and that's kind of where we left off last time. So 1 Samuel chapter 7, beginning at verse 7 is where we're going to pick up. So what happens is the Philistines, they find out that the Israelites are all gathered at Mizpah, and they decide, hey, here's a good chance for us to attack. So they hear about this gathering, and the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel, it says. And it says when the Israelites heard about this, they were afraid of the Philistines. It's sort of tables are turned here. Remember last time, the battle where we lost the ark, the Philistines heard the ark, the shout of the people when the ark came into the camp, and the Philistines were afraid. Well, now it's the Israelites who are afraid of the Philistines.
This is a little bit understandable.
Given their history.
You had the Philistines beat down the Israelites. And then the Israelites go get the ark, and the Philistines are afraid, but they beat them down again. And now here they come a third time, many years later, obviously. But if you're the Israelites, you got to be thinking, let's see, these guys whooped us. Then we went and got our God out, and they whooped us again and took our God, and now here they come again. There's not a lot of reasons to think that this is going to go any different.
You know, no, from a human perspective, for sure.
No, no. Now, Chad, I have to ask, this is completely unrelated, because someone asked me this just the other day. If the Ark was discovered, you know, as an Old Testament nerd like yourself,
yeah,
you'd probably be fairly interested if this was discovered. But so they asked me, if it was discovered, would you look inside?
And
knowing you like Christ has come, you know, like would you do it? Like, and I'm like, I don't know if I would do that or not.
Things did not go well.
Would you when, do? Is it, is it, have things changed such, Chad, that you'd be like, you can look, it's fine.
Yeah, I'm a little conflicted there.
Or you want someone else to do it first?
Yeah, that'd be fine. Yeah, let's let somebody else do it. The theological side of me is like, oh yeah, it's fine, because you know that was the old covenant, and Christ is now our Ark of the Covenant. You know, all of that, all of which is theologically true. And then there's the psychological part of me. It's like, don't do it. Do not do it. Don't mess with it. Just leave it as it is. No need to peer inside it. Just leave the lid shut. So I'm a little bit conflicted there. So what I would do?
Yeah, that's what I said.
What did you say? Did you say no?
I said I'd let someone else do it first.
All right, so we're agreed on that. I want to be watching it from a distance on video. Yeah. See what happens.
Yeah, I don't even know. Yeah, you're like, I'll be like, nervous about a live stream. I'm like, if I see it, am I done? Like, I want to see
pre-recorded.
I want to see like a photograph of someone doing it, but I don't want to actually see what's inside of it. I don't even want to look at a photograph until I know that someone else looked in and it was fine.
So we are definitely in agreement on that.
Yeah. Even though, correct, theologically, I'm like, should be fine.
Oh, yeah.
Should be
fine.
But should you go fine. Make sure.
You be our front man.
Yeah, it reminds me of when I was putting in a new light fixture, and one of the label on our breaker box on the circuit, like, it had been worn off, and I was like, I'm pretty sure it's this one for this bedroom. And I turned that thing off, and I'm like, yeah, that's it. I'm standing, and I get up there, and I'm about to do it, and I tell my wife, I was like, go plug something into that wall over there.
And just double check.
She's like, why? Didn't you turn the breaker off? I'm like, I'm pretty sure. I'm like 99% sure I did, but I don't feel like touching this particular wire.
Live wire.
Until you make sure. That's what it is. Like, I'm pretty sure it's fine, but...
Yeah, because I've made that mistake before where it was a wrongly labeled breaker.
Yes.
So I shut it off, but it was not shutting off the room that I was working in, and so I got a shock.
Yes.
So I learned my lesson.
Yeah. Okay, that's a total aside. Sorry about that, guys, but hopefully that was entertaining at the very least. We just don't do it, apparently. Let someone else do it. Okay, right. So we're gonna find out what happens. Third time's a charm, going to battle with the Philistines.
Yeah. So they wise up this time. There's no mention whatsoever of getting the ark. Instead, they talk to Samuel. They say to Samuel, don't stop praying for us, more or less. Do not cease to cry to the Lord our God for us, that he may save us from the hand of the Philistines. This whole history would have been different if that's the way they'd have started out way back. But of course, they did not. So they say to Samuel, keep interceding for us. Keep doing what you're doing, because implicit in that is our only hope is going to be in the Lord. So what does Samuel do? Well, first of all, he takes a lamb and he offers it for as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. And then it says he cried to the Lord for Israel and the Lord answered him. And then verse 10, now Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, and the Philistines drew near to the battle against Israel. So all this is happening at the same time. Samuel has an altar built. He's offering this lamb. He's praying to God. And while all of this is transpiring, the Philistines and the Israelites are lining up in battle array. So I'm assuming the whole burnt offering is kind of like a sin offering, I guess you might say. It accompanied the prayers, as of course it did throughout the tabernacle and temple's history. Anytime there was a morning or an evening sacrifice, during that time is when the people would pray. There's this connection always between prayer and sacrifice, which from a Christian perspective is just perfect, because all our prayers don't just go like directly from our lips to God's ear. Our prayers are filtered through the sacrifice of Christ. So anytime that we pray, for instance, our Father, we're calling him our Father based on the fact that we are praying through and in his crucified and resurrected Son. So all prayer goes through sacrifice. And it was like that in the Old Testament as well. So the sacrifice of this lamb was, as it were, the means by which the prayers rose up to the Lord. And what does God do? How does he respond? He responds with thunder, which is pretty remarkable. It said that the Lord thundered thundered with a great thunder. Literally, it's he thundered with a great voice on that day against the Philistines and confused them so that they were routed before Israel. Now, this is perfect because if you go back to Hannah's song, which is in chapter 2, verse 10, she says, this is at the very end of her little canticle. She says, "Those who contend with the Lord will be shattered. Against them he will thunder in the heavens. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth." And same Hebrew word, verb for thunder in both those cases. So the Lord is thundering down against the Philistines. What's beautiful about this is that, okay, the first time the Israelites lost and the second time the Israelites lost, they were the ones doing the fighting. So they fought against the Philistines. The Philistines responded and achieved a victory against them both times. This time, it's God who fights for Israel. He's the one who's thundering down this confusing, loud noise. Philistines are confused, and they end up being defeated before the Israelites. So the simple truth is that anytime that the Israelites win a victory, it's because the Lord is the one who's fighting for them. I mean, you have this already back at the Red Sea, right? The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is fighting for the Israelites. And back then, the Israelites didn't do anything but walk across the sea on dry land. Moses tells them, basically, shut up and watch what God does. And that's what he does. He fights for them. And this is another case of the Lord fighting from heaven for his people. So he thunders with the great thunder. The Philistines are confused and they're routed before Israel. The men of Israel went out of Mizpah, pursued the Philistines, and struck them down as far as below Beth Kar. So they achieved a resounding victory. Samuel, it says in verse 12, took a stone and he set it up between Mizpah and Shin, and he named this stone Ebenezer, saying, "Thus far the Lord has helped us." So Ebenezer, as you can probably figure out, even if you don't know Hebrew, means the stone of help. So Ebenezer. We've heard about Ebenezer a couple of different times. It came up at the beginning of chapter 4, beginning of chapter 5 as well. So this is a place that marks this victory where the Lord was the stone of help for the Israelites.
This is useful, Chad, this Ebenezer, because there's probably a bunch of people out there that have sung "Come Thou Fount" a million times and are trying to figure out, you know,
what Ebenezer means.
when that second stanza comes in and they say, you know, "Here I raise my Ebenezer, here by thy great help I've come," they're like, I the only Ebenezer they know is the Scrooge kind.
Yeah.
So this is a weird. I remember when I was a kid, back before, you know, I was this brilliant Old Testament scholar, thinking, I have no idea what I'm singing about right now. Like,
what does this have to do with Scrooge? I don't get it.
Very strange. But if you know that this is what this is, this line, makes a lot of sense. And it's actually, hopefully what it does is next time you sing "Thou Come Thou Fount," you'll be like, oh, here I raise my Ebenezer. This is, here I set this stone, by your great help. I've come. And this is, of course, a song, you've come to salvation by the help of the Lord. But yeah, that's what that verse means. And this is, I would assume, I don't know, I would assume this is the text that it's getting it from.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I would assume that as well. Yeah. Is anybody named Ebenezer anymore? I mean, have you ever known?
I have not.
We need to bring that back that name. Okay. Listeners, if one of you is, you know, you got a son, it's going to be born soon.
It's a good name.
Add that to your list of possible. Yeah. I mean, it's a great name.
Yeah.
Great
name. It's not going to be us, Chad.
No, it will not be us. Yeah, I might get suggested as a name for a grandson one of these days.
There you go.
But yeah, I'm definitely in the grandparenting phase of my life. Two grandsons and a granddaughter.
There you go.
Who will be born around Thanksgiving. So yeah, family keeps expanding.
That's awesome. Well, yeah. So little side note there, but might be helpful in your hymnody next.
Yeah,
time.
I'm glad you brought that up. I actually had thought about that earlier, then I just blanked out when we were actually talking about it. I think, well, it probably comes up in other hymns as well, but that at least is a very well-known hymn.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of, I don't know that there is another passage that they would have pulled that from.
No, I'm pretty sure it has to be that. And I didn't look to see if it's mentioned elsewhere. I mean, it is, as I said, in chapter 4 and 5, I don't remember if it comes up elsewhere in the rest of the Old Testament, but I'm sure that's what the hymn writer was getting at.
And yeah, another thing that's interesting, Chad, is we talked about this before, but you ever notice that when Israel goes out to do something in their own strength, there's always a body count. And whenever the Lord goes out and fights for them, there's no reference to any losses on the Israelite side. How big of a route was it? Well, you're literally left with no indication that Israel lost any people.
Right, right.
And this is how it always works whenever God goes out. Like when God goes out, he does all the work, and it seems as though Israel remains completely unscathed. And when they go out in their own strength, probably with some misplaced confidence due to victories like this, they go out in their own strength and they just get their head beat off.
Yeah, it's always a body count. Yeah, that's a great point to make, because I don't think people often catch that when they're reading through these. I mean, are we saying there was no Israelites? Well, yeah, maybe there were, but there's none ever recorded, right?
Yeah, no.
It's just like enemies wiped out and the Israelites are all standing strong and healthy after.
Yeah, and this is why the Lord is a warrior is good news.
Yeah, if you're like one man standing against an army of a million, but you have the Lord on your side, you outnumber the enemy every single time. It doesn't matter whether you're facing the Philistines or you're facing the Egyptians or later you're facing the Assyrians. Remember that one episode during Hezekiah's reign when the Assyrians are threatening the Israelites? They've camped outside Jerusalem and the angel of the Lord goes in and wipes out how many tens of thousands of the Assyrians, and the Israelites didn't do anything. They were inside the city. They found out later what the Lord had done. So yeah, when he fights for you, the victory is complete and the victory is sure. So verse 13 tells us, kind of picking up after Ebenezer, that the Philistines were subdued. They didn't come anymore within the borders of Israel, and the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. So not only that, it says that all the cities that the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel. So they got their territory back. They got their cities back. And there was, at least for a time anyway, a period of relative tranquility. And then verse 15 almost sounds like it was lifted from the book of Judges. And of course, a lot of the stuff we've been covering is kind of still in that. Not in the book of Judges, but it's in that whole time frame. Because verse 15 says, now Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. So Samuel really is kind of the last of the judges. And we start out all the way back in the beginning of Judges with our first one, and we have all of these other guys in between. And now we finally get to Samuel. So he's the one who's going to close out this particular period.
Yeah, it's a weird thing because, you know, Eli talked about that, and he doesn't seem like a judge, really. He's like a priest judge guy. Mm-hmm. And Samuel is not like these other judges because he's like a prophet judge guy. And, so you see this weird phasing out where there's dual roles going on. Leading up to no more judges, but the people are going to want something different. And we've been alluding to for a while that as we went through Judges, and the refrain over and over again was, now there was no king in Israel. Mm-hmm. And this is certainly going to be the end of Judges.
Yeah, they kind of, I guess we'll get there in a second, but they kind of want basically what we might call like a super judge, right? they want somebody to judge, but they want them to do a whole lot more than simply that. So, just to wrap up chapter 7, it says that Samuel would go on this circuit of different cities. He went annually to Bethel and Gilgal and Mizpah, and he judged Israel in all these places. Presumably, he was doing some actually judging work. I can't say judicial work, but probably also teaching, and because he was also sacrificing, I assume he was also leading some kind of sacrificial services as well. Anyway, he'd go back to Ramah because that's where he lived. That was, if you remember way back at the beginning, that's where his family was from. So that's where he ended up settling was in Ramah. And his house was there. He judged Israel and he built an altar to the Lord there as well. And sometime he must have got married, because we're going to hear about his sons in the next chapter. So we don't know anything about his wife, but sometime he got married, they had children, and we're going to hear about those children in the beginning of chapter 8. So what happens in chapter 8? Chapter 8 is a big chapter in as far as this transition goes, because this is when we're going to hear about Israel's request for a king. So it starts out by describing a little bit about Samuel and his sons and the disappointment that the Israelites have over his sons. So Samuel's old at this point. So a lot of time has passed. We started out chapter 1. He's just, you know, he's a baby. And then he's a teenager when he's called. And now all of a sudden we moved all the way forward to where he is. He's an old man, whatever that means, you know, however you want to designate that. He appointed his sons as judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel. The name of his second was Abijah. And they were in Beersheba. His sons, however, we're told, did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. This seems to be a pretty common biblical theme. That, I mean, it's either like, especially when you get to the kings, it's like you'll have a great king, and then his son will be just like a total loser.
Yeah, you know,
and then his son will be a good king.
When we're told that, like, raise your children in the way they should go and they will not depart from it. And then you read the Bible and you're like, are you sure? You sure about that? Because it seems to me that
there's a lot of exceptions to that rule.
This seems like it, you know, unless these guys are like, you know, great leaders of men, but terrible fathers. I don't know. Very possible. But you know, this is like the trope, man. Right. I mean, the PK is a thing, you know, like the pastor's kid.
Yes. Yes.
I know about this. 'Cause I was one of those. It's a weird thing, man. There's this rebellious streak in all people. You're going to refuse to do what your father did.
Yeah. 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 I do think that is the case. And yeah, we have the trope is all over the scriptures, right? You'll have you see that in the case of David. I mean, David, of course, has his skeletons in his closet. But if you look at his sons, man, you have the one son who is rebelling against him and staging a coup. You have another son who ends up on the throne, Rehoboam. But he is not him, but Solomon. You know, Solomon starts out good, but then the end of Solomon's life, and he's just an old idolater, more or less. And then his son is a problem as well. So, yeah, it's a, I don't know. It could be one of these cases where, yeah, he's a great leader of men, but he's not that great of a father. That's certainly a possibility. But what's strange about this particular story is that, so Samuel was brought up around, you know, Eli, who was not that good of a priest. He was brought up around Eli's sons, who were definitely not good men. And he turned out to be, a faithful follower, one of the most renowned prophets in the Old Testament. But then his sons, it seems, ended up more like Eli's sons.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just one of those situations where, yeah, I mean, you do your best to raise your children, and you hope that they will remain faithful, but sometimes it doesn't turn out that way. Or sometimes, you know, as often also happens, they'll go through a phase of rebellion, and then you watch as the Lord calls them back.
I suppose that does say when they are old, they will not depart from it. So I guess there is like a middle part where they most certainly will.
Right. And at least judging from the people I know and what I myself have experienced, yeah, that tends to be the way things work out. So what's going to happen? Well, verse 4 says the elders get together and they go to Samuel and they say, look, you've grown old, Samuel, and your sons do not walk in your ways. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations. So this is a loaded statement. First of all, of course, Israel has never been without a king. It's just that the king they've always had has been Yahweh and Yahweh alone. He's always been the one who's been reigning over them. So when they speak of wanting a king, it's basically a rejection of the Lord being their king. So that's the one problem. So they're basically acting as if they currently are without a king, whereas they've had a king the entire time. So that's the one issue. And the other issue is the reason they want a king. They don't say, now appoint a king over us so that, you know, we'll have this one particular person that we can look up to as an authority. Now, they want a king so that they can be like all the Goyim, so they can be like all the nations around them. Anytime that God's people say they want something so that they can be like all the nations, it doesn't matter what that something is, it's not going to be good, because Israel is to be a people set apart. They're to be unlike the nations that are around them.
Well, it seems like there's sort of a leap here, right? You can understand why some elders of Israel will come to Samuel as he's getting old and say, hey, your sons are jacked, man. Like you're getting old. These guys ain't going to cut it. Right? They are the apple has fallen far from the tree, man. So you need to pick someone else.
Yeah, that would make sense.
That would make sense, right? So right. Like if they said that, you could be like, well, this argument has some validity to it, you know?
Yeah, you might not like to hear it, but you could think, oh, well, yeah, okay.
Yeah, you could go in there and be like, you got some real Eli stuff going on here, and we don't want to do that. But they don't. They make this jump to say, they start with the sons as the excuse to bring it up, right? Like, hey, your sons, they're whack, dude. Give us a king. Now, that's a pretty big leap, right? We're like, to go from we need someone else who's not corrupt to let's just go straight king, because now you're talking about succession. I mean, what you're complaining about is that the next people that are next up that you've appointed, your sons, well, they're corrupt and bad. But when you start asking for a king, you've now locked yourself into like, what, there's no guarantee that this same thing is going to happen, and you have no way out of this when you set up this kind of system.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, as we were just talking about, that's precisely what happens, right?
Yeah.
And they do get locked into it. You're like, well, you wanted a king, and so look at the list of kings that you're given.
I mean,
there's no way to get away from it.
I mean, it is a weird argument, man, to make that your lineage is not doing well give a let's do a royal lineage. This is not a good argument.
No. No, they did not think this through before they made this.
They'd be better off being like, your sons are messed up. Let's try democracy. Like,
you know. Right. Maybe we should have an election. Let's try a president for a while. Yeah, so they're making a huge leap for in this particular request. So, well, what's the reaction going to be? Verse 6 says that as far as Samuel was concerned, the thing was, well, my translation has displeasing. In the Hebrew, it's evil. So it was evil in the eyes of Samuel. He did not think this was a good idea when they said, give us a king to judge us. So Samuel prayed to the Lord, and presumably he let the Lord know what he thought about it. And here's how God responded. He says, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you. So in other words, all right, what they're saying is what you are to do. Because they have not rejected you, presumably, maybe that's what Samuel thought, right? They rejected me. They haven't rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. So just when you thought that everything was kind of, yeah, going pretty good for Israel, they get rid of the Baals, they get rid of the goddesses, they repent, they turn to the Lord, they have a successful battle, you know. But some years go by, and then all of a sudden, now they've rejected the Lord once again in a different sort of way. They've not rejected him in the sense of they've gone back to the Baals, at least not that we know of, but they have rejected him from being king over them. So goes on, he says, like all the deeds which they have done since the day that I brought them up from Egypt, even to this day,
and that they have forsaken me. This is God saying, look, nothing new under the sun, man. yeah. These people rejecting me is not an unfamiliar feeling.
Yeah, I've traveled this road many times before. Yeah, so they rejected him in that they have forsaken me and served other gods. So they are doing to you also. And then he wraps it up. He says, so then listen to their voice. However, you shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the, I don't know, how do you translate this? Procedure of the king, tradition of the king. What does ESV have there? Tell them of the
procedure.
Procedure. Okay. So it's, in the Hebrew, it's mishpat, which can be translated like, usually it's justice, but it's like, it can be translated like tradition or way of proceeding.
Customs.
Yeah. Customs, yeah. Something like that. So tell them of the mishpat, the customs of the king who will reign over them. So this is a case where, and you see other examples of this as well, where God will give the people that which they have requested, even though he knows that when they receive it, it's not going to be what they think it's going to be. In fact, very often when we receive something that we want, it ends up being the exact opposite of what's best for us. So as someone once told me, that God's wrath often looks like getting exactly what you want.
Yeah.
So, you see this in the opening chapter of Romans, right? God handed them over to their desires.
But this is what hell is. When you say, yeah, I don't want God, and he says, finally, well, then you won't have me. Final judgment is giving you what you want, which is separation from God.
Yeah, what is the C.S. Lewis quote? Something like, to the person who will not say to God, thy will be done, God finally says, thy will be done.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. So he gives them what they have requested.
Yeah. And, what's also interesting about this is that, you know, when he talks about the customs of the king, I mean, basically God's saying, give them what they want. Also tell them what kings are like.
Yeah.
So make sure that you give them what they want, and you make sure to tell them exactly how kings operate. What we're going to see, I mean, of course, you know, Israel's going to have good kings and bad kings and all this kind of stuff. David being the most famous of all the kings. But if you want an example of something that isn't good, which is Israel rejecting God and asking for a king, Samuel doesn't think it's good. God doesn't think it's good. He says it's an outright rejection of him. But if you want an example of God working all things together for good, this is it. Because Christ, Jesus, like David, is a pivotal character in the bringing about of the Messiah. I mean, he is the son of David after all. I mean, this is, and it's not like God didn't see this one coming. He's working this together for good long before it happens. As we just went through Ruth, and we know where Jesse comes from, which is David's father. So yeah, it's bad. And it's also something that God is going to necessarily work with, because that's what he does.
Yeah. I mean, it's not exactly analogous, but it's somewhat parallel to the same situation that happens with the temple, right? David wants to build a temple for the Lord, and God's like, I've been living in a tent. I'm fine with a tent. But he ends up allowing David to build that temple to him. And so he uses, he uses the bad request for a good end. And certainly that's a case in the matter of the Kings. And I will say this, I mean, there was forethought on the part of Moses, because in Deuteronomy chapter 17, it talks about the time when Israel will have a king. So Deuteronomy 17 lays down kind of the guidelines. Like if you do say, I will set a king over me, like all the nations who are around me, this is Deuteronomy 17, 14 and following. Well, then here's how he is to be. Here's the things he is not to do. So there was a foreshadowing of this taking place, but that doesn't in any way diminish the fact that Israel, in making this request, was also rejecting God as their king over them.
Yeah.
So what kind of king? Well, I mean, what's going to be like when you have a king? What kind of warning are they going to receive? Well, I'll just read through this real briefly. So this is what Samuel tells him. Is this what's going to happen? You want a king? Okay. So this is going to be the tradition of the king. This is verse 11 and following. He's going to take your sons and is going to place them for himself in his chariots and among his horsemen, and they will run before his chariots. And then he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and fifties, and then he'll have some do his plowing and some do his reaping and some making his weapons and his equipment for his chariots. So that's what he's going to do with your sons. And then for your daughters, he's going to take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. And not only that, but he's going to take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves and give them to his cronies. And then he's going to take a tenth of your crops from you to give to his officers and his servants. And he's going to take some of you to be his male servants and his female servants. He's going to take your best young men and your donkeys. He's going to take some of your flocks. He's going to take this. He's going to take that. And then, verse 18, then you will cry out in that day because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourself. But the Lord will not answer you in that day.
Now, this is pretty bleak.
What a way to end.
Pretty bleak. I love that their response is, whatever, dude, that's what we're in for.
Yeah, that's
we're here for it, man.
I mean, this whole list, this is long description of all this bad stuff the king is going to do. And verse 19 says, no, but there shall be a king over us. Yeah, it's just like, whatever. We want a king because we want to be like all the nations. So our king can judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. So Samuel hears the words of the people and he repeats them in the hearing of the Lord. And the chapter wraps up with the Lord telling Samuel, listen to their voice and appoint them a king. So Samuel tells them to basically go home, go every man to his city. So that wraps up the introduction to the whole request for a king and what happens afterward. That takes us to the end of chapter 8. Next time, we're going to hear about Israel's first king and find out what kind of guy he is.
It's exactly the kind of guy that sinners would appoint to be king.
Tall, handsome.
That's it.
Exactly the kind of guy they'd look for.
That's it. All right, guys. Well, thanks for hanging out with us. Go over and register for the online conference. We'd love to have you join us for that. We will be back next week with some stuff about Israel's first king. Chad, I'll see you then.
All right. See you then.